I have an enormous pleasure to be here at Worldcon with Greg Bossert, layout supervisor at Industrial Light and Magic. And I think almost every film fan knows who is Industrial Light and Magic. So, dear Greg, please make a short presentation of your professional background first for our listeners.
Sure. And as we were discussing earlier, I came to film through a very strange path. I got a degree in English. I did study a little bit of film in English, but like everybody takes courses on things they're interested in, but you never think that you will work in this industry. It's just for fun and for credit. I went off to work in the computer business, and I think we'll talk about this, but I was always interested in graphics though, so in my day job, I was doing computer graphics. At night, I was often doing music or sound recording or audio recording or sound effects. And for theater and for rock groups from friends, nothing very serious. It was just something to do. And that went for many, many years. Sometime around the 1990, I wanted to get more serious about doing computer graphics, and I was thinking, you know, okay, I love these movies. It's just when Jurassic Park has come out. And I thought, that was really cool. That's amazing. So I applied for a job at Silicon Graphics in California that did the computers. They actually built the hardware that was used to render the dinosaurs. And I got a job. So I came out. At first, I worked for the internal IS department, and then I got a job as a consultant where I would go to customers and help them set up their Silicon Graphics machines. I never got to work on a film project, but we worked with some TV studios and so forth. And I always knew that these people were just down the road. We would drive past Industrial Light and Magic and see if we could see anything. And often they were filming a special effects shot, and you could see flames or smoke or a spaceship. Sometimes even in the trash, there would be a spaceship, and we'd go, look at it. And after a while, I started combining my evening activities and my daytime activities. So we would have a short film for a computer conference, and I would do sound or sound effects or music for it or help with the editing. And I did more and more of that until I was invited to work on a project by Doug Chang. He's an art director. He designed those classic robots, the droids from Star Wars Episodes 1, 2, and 3. And he had a short project that he was pitching and needed sound effects. So I did this, and it went pretty well. And so I did sound effects and music for him for a while. He is a designer, and he was asked to design the film Beowulf, written by Neil Gaiman and Roger Avery, and directed by Robert Zemeckis. And he had never heard of this Beowulf. Nobody who worked in the film really had. But this is where my English degree ended up being very useful. I said, I have read the book. So that's when I switched over to working full-time in feature film, and I came in as a researcher and helped find, what would a Viking shoe look like, or what kind of textures we can find for a dragon skin, or can you just find scenery from places that might look like a fantastic setting, so Iceland or anywhere in the north. And I went from there, from job to job to job, and finally to Industrial Light and Magic. At first, I worked for Lucasfilm Animation, on a project that was originally written by George Lucas, and that was up at the famous Skywalker Ranch out in the hillsides of California. After that, now I've moved down to the San Francisco office where Industrial Light and Magic is based, and then worked my way up to be a layout supervisor. And the last films I worked on there were Captain Marvel. I was the layout supervisor for Captain Marvel, and before that, Bumblebee and A Quiet Place. And then, again, my full resume is there on IMDb or on my website.
Okay, yeah. So it was a step-by-step gradual transition.
Yes, and every step a surprise to me. You know, always some lucky skill. You know, I just happened to have liked music, and that led me to do the sound effects and music. I was always fascinated by those radio plays and what they call Foley, which is where you do the sound effects of footsteps and so forth. And so I would build some stuff. Somebody thought that was cool, so they mentioned my name to somebody else. I will say that every bit of education I had in college ended up being useful. my English degree, my film courses, all of that finally came together, but not in an obvious way.
But when you say ILM, you say George Lucas.
Yes. So my first job at Lucasfilm was for Lucasfilm Animation, working on a project that came out as Strange Magic. And it was a story he used to tell his children. And he wrote the story, and project came and went. It was always a side project, but Star Wars was his great passion. And he worked also, of course, on Clone Wars. There was a section of Skywalker Ranch called Big Rock with a beautiful building, and they were making Clone Wars there and this movie, Strange Magic. So I was brought in the what they call the story department, pre-visualization department. So we had some storyboards, but also some simple animations. And I was a little bit of the everything guy. I would help with editing, with sound, with computer programming. So even my programming days came useful. And George was there, and he, in the mornings, would work on Clone Wars, and in the evenings, would go up and work on this film. A very nice man and a huge inspiration, very passionate, also very quiet, though. And but it was just about this time that he was looking to move on to something new, and he sold the company to Disney. So after a year of working directly with him, he sold the company. He's still active at Skywalker Ranch. He keeps the film studio there, and very occasionally we're lucky enough to see him when we go up for lunch or something like that. But now he's largely working on philanthropy, on giving away money. You know, he's made a lot of money over the years, and he's determined to do good with it. He has an educational fund, as an example, that I hear when I drive to work, I hear that they have commercials saying they've funded this radio show or that project. So,
you said a very interesting thing at your presentation just before this interview, that not so many directors are coming to the VFX department to, as you said, make them that their hands dirty.
Yes.
But who was your favorite director to work with?
I'm going to name a couple, but they're all very different. Every project is very different. And even though we're an industry and we go through sometimes 5-6 movies in a year, every project is surprising. Every client is different. Some of my favorites, I mentioned Gareth Edwards from Rogue One. He came and worked with us in the studio, and that's very rare. Usually the director is in Hollywood or in France, and they will Skype in or otherwise, you know, phone call in, or we send some stuff and they write back emails. He came and sat with us day by day. Luc Besson, I worked with him on Lucy, and again, he's a craftsman. He loves all the aspects. And he was there very often and very generous, very saying, your ideas, surprise me, do something I didn't expect. Travis Knight on Bumblebee is a stop motion animator who worked on Coraline and many of these films from the Leica studio, and he founded the Leica studio, and he's one of us. So he would come and talk, particularly with the animation team, and he really understood the art. And then a director I did not work with, but I heard him, wonderful man, is Guillermo del Toro. He would come, we were working on Pacific Rim, and I was sitting in one section of the building, but you could hear him from the other side. And he would demand to go sit with individual artists and ask what they're doing. Again, welcoming ideas. A friend of mine, Isung Lee, working in my department, was able to pitch several ideas that made it into Pacific Rim. Very generous man, great lover of film. One of us. If he were here now, he would be having a blast.
What is most stressful in the film industry, making a deadline or fitting into the budget?
It's really the same problem. It's the flip side, and it's a balancing act. And you know this famous thing, you can have quality or schedule or budget, you know, and you only get two of those. And we always want the quality. Personally, it's the deadline, individually, because we spend a lot of time. I was the layout supervisor in Ready Player One, and a huge, huge project. And I was on for 15 months, often 75 hours a week. So long hours, a wonderful team. You get to be very close friends. You have late nights. Maybe some beer comes out after, you know, 9 o'clock at night. But it's exhausting and it's difficult for your home life or your social life. The budget from a professional viewpoint is often the factor. There's what you always want to do more, but every second of film costs money. Every extra prop, every extra bit of footage brought in costs money. In my presentation, you saw that we went for Rogue One and shot some individual film elements to put into some shots, and they really bring the scene to life. If we could, we would do that for every sequence, but sometimes you just don't have the budget to go out. It takes a lot of money to bring camera and crew, and then you need to feed those people and you need to transport those people. So personally, deadline, professionally, budget, but we have very good producers. The whole production side of the business, often not acknowledged, often overworked as the artists, and they balance those things and we get there somehow.
You've partially addressed this question in the previous intervention, but would you give us some detail of how much of your input is accepted by a director?
Sure, and I can give a couple of fun examples that I didn't mention before. It depends from director to director, film to film. And I've worked on some wonderful films where the director had a very clear vision and didn't need any input. And that's fine. Sometimes it's easier for us because there's no ambiguity. We know we have to do this, this, and this. Nowadays, more and more directors are exploring new ideas with us in post-production. And there's a team called the pre-visualization team. These are the storyboard artists and the animators who do very rough versions before the film starts. Now we have a crazy post-visualization. We've shot the film, but we don't really know what's going to happen. And that's where it can be very exciting for me. In Tomorrowland, there was a scene where they're traveling to Tomorrowland in a spaceship. It takes off from the Eiffel Tower, goes through an interdimensional portal, and then there's white letters on black text in the original cut of the film said, "Spaceship crashes." So what we do is we come in over a weekend and we try a lot of ideas. Does it run into some buildings? Does it have parachutes like an Apollo spaceship, or maybe special rays or beams that break it somehow? We try a bunch of options. We send those off. The director thinks about, you know, this works, this doesn't, sends us some notes, and we go back and forth. That's a very fun process. And maybe the director doesn't know that I did this shot and my friend did this shot, but you feel part of this creative back and forth. And sometimes he'll send back new ideas so that spaceship crashes turn into spaceship hits a building, spaceship hits two buildings, and then we continue to do new versions and iterations. On a movie like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, they had some rewrites. And so they just said, please give us some ideas. And so a little team of myself and a friend went and did whole scenes. And we would work with the writer, would send us some dialogue, and we just kind of act out in very rough blocking. The director even sent us an action figure filmed with his iPhone. So this kind of back and forth can be very, very fun. And then finally, something I showed you in this presentation that I just gave on Rogue One, little things there. We needed the Death Star in a shot, and they give a sketch, a storyboard. It's just a circle. And so I take it and I just turn it until it looks right. And the director's like, yeah, that looks good. So it's been different kinds of interactions. When that happens, it's very exciting. So I love those moments. Other times I'm part of a big, big team and I can't say I did any one thing, but still together we got the picture up on the screen.
You said a very interesting thing that you and your team got over the weekend and did this and did that. Sure. It's a usual thing to work in weekends.
You know, when you're given the option to do some creative work like that, you say, of course I'll come in. Again, we have very good production people, and they build a schedule that assumes maybe 45 hours a week for the length of the film, but it's show business, and nothing ever sticks. And this is true of any business, so some projects have been very calm. Very often, though, I'll come in, and now that I'm a supervisor, I feel responsible, so I'll come in if any of my people are working. But these little side projects, so we need a space battle for Rogue One. We came in two or three weekends and just different ideas, and the editorial team tries cutting them in different ways. One crazy example of working on weekends is we were working on Bumblebee, and then we got the chance to work on A Quiet Place, the John Krasinski film with Emily Blunt. And we didn't have enough staff. So during the day, we work on Bumblebee, and after about 7 o'clock and on weekends, we work on A Quiet Place with the same team. But that was a very exciting, because Quiet Place, very cool film, new filmmaker, and so we didn't mind. We took a break, we had dinner, and then we went back to our desks, and we charged ahead. So,
please share with us some tips for the beginner in the film industry.
I will say the most important thing you need if you want to work in the film industry is a love of film, for a number of different reasons. One is it's a difficult job. It takes a while to get in, and you have to really want to work in the industry to get there. There are a lot of opportunities at the low level, and sometimes you're sweeping floors. I had a job. I was sweeping the floor. I was getting lunches. I was also doing research. Sometimes you will do an internship, and then maybe there's nothing for the first year. Another thing that really helps is if you go out and do your own project, and it could be as simple as your iPhone. When you're a professional, you have a reel. It's no longer a film reel, but you show your work. But if you come in as a beginner and say, I'm passionate, here's some little films, they may not watch them all the way through, but they see that passion. And it's a way for you to learn the terminology and the techniques. It's easier and cheaper than ever to work on your iPhone. There are programs like DaVinci Resolve, a free editorial package, professional level, or Blender, which is a free open source animation and modeling package. I absolutely encourage people to play around, have some fun. Even if it's a 5-second movie clip, that will help you. Interning is good. Studying in school is fantastic. Don't be surprised if what you do in the film industry is not what you studied in school. But again, that's a way of getting experience, learning the technology, and watching lots of films, you know? So I know a lot of people everywhere from artists in the art department to animators, compositing, even some supervisors who never thought they would work in film industry. And as I was saying, I drive over the Golden Gate Bridge to the office every day, amazed that here I am going to work at Industrial Light and Magic. So don't give up is my last bit of advice for beginners. It's the best time in the history of film to get into the business, because not just feature film in theaters, Netflix, Disney has a streaming service coming out, YouTube, Facebook, video games have cutscenes that are as good as film. The video game industry is larger than the film industry, and the quality is as good. It's the best time ever. If you're passionate about science fiction film, fantasy film, anything, please give it a try, and I think you'll find an opportunity.
You have an interesting hobby to design and build experimental musical instruments. Please tell us more about this.
So I said that I used to do mixing for rock groups, and I was in a few terrible rock groups in the 80s, beep, boop, beep kind of stuff. But I also loved sound design and this old, the Foley, which is where you add the footsteps to a movie, or the radio sound effects where you'd have the guy with a table full of equipment. So I researched how to build these devices. And I got from there into this whole community, a fascinating community you can find on the web, of building experimental music instruments. And there's a long history back in Europe in particular to the Dadaists and Surrealists, and they would build strange devices. In France, you had the Musique Concrète, which was the recording onto vinyl discs or acetate discs and building musical constructions from real-world sounds before there were tape recorders. IRCAM, I-R-C-A-M, is the famous French Institute for Experimental Music. And then in the Bay Area, Lou Harrison was a musician and composer and professor, but also built his own instruments inspired by Balinese or Javanese instruments, but out of parts he could find in California. Harry Parch was another great Californian experimental musician. He would just find rubbish and build something. So I got very passionate. And if you go to my website, you find these instruments. Sometimes I just find things at work that people have thrown out, or I built a guitar from a flower pot. and some scrap wood. It's fun, and I use these in my own short films. I did a series of short films for the Weird Tales magazine called 1 Minute Weird Tales, and you can find them still on YouTube or on my website, where I use these experimental instruments and sound effects devices to build soundscapes. And the movie will be 1 minute long with white text telling a short story from another author, but then I add the sounds, and often the strange instruments that I've built are used to do these sound effects or soundscapes.
Please tell us the address of your website.
There are two. You can find some of my film work, not enough, but some of it at www.suddensound, as in a sharp sound, suddensound.com. And then you can find more about my writing and my film career, my professional career, at gregorynormanbossert.com. And that also has links to my short stories and links to some of my online short films.
Tell us about your writing.
So, the film industry comes and goes. As I said, don't be discouraged if you're a beginner. I had gotten a job doing research, and I worked on Beowulf and Disney A Christmas Carol, and then it was very hard to find this research work. So I was sitting around with an artist friend, Ian McCaig. He designed Darth Maul. He's got a long history. He's a brilliant illustrator, book covers, album covers. He did a Jethro Tull album cover. And he literally looked me in the eye and said, I dare you to write a screenplay. So you're a creative guy. People should want to work with you. Write a screenplay. And I was very intimidated. I said, okay. But I did. And it's very hard to sell a screenplay in Hollywood. And now I know this would be a $200 million effects spectacular. But I loved the writing. So I started writing short stories. I was very fortunate that my first short story sale, which was in 2010, was to Sheila Williams of Asimov's Science Fiction magazine. And I got the cover image. And so I've sold now 8 stories to Asimov's Science Fiction. But then I wanted to try other genres. I've sold a lot of fantasy stories to an online magazine called Beneath Ceaseless Skies. And very fortunate that one of those won the World Fantasy Award for Best Short Story. And that is available for free online, beneathceaselessskies.com, and you can see my fantasy stories there. And now I've tried a little horror and maybe some more realistic stuff. I got a story in the Saturday Evening Post, a famous American magazine that's online. And I love it, and when I come to a conference like the World Science Fiction Convention, I get to wear both my film hat and my writer hat. And I am a science fiction and fantasy book fan, too, and it's a huge delight to see my favorite authors walking around. So very exciting for me to be here, both as a writer and a reader, and then as a filmmaker.
If you had to decide which one of your subjects of interest, working in film industry, writing, and music, would you continue pursuing?
It's a very difficult...
Just one.
Just one. The answer has changed. I think 10 years ago, I would say film, because my whole life I've loved films. I had this chance to work with Lucasfilm, and in many ways it was my dream job. But as I've been writing, this act of sitting and being creative is extraordinary. It's a little mysterious. It's scary to think of writing full time, because I still don't know how I come up with my ideas. It's just magic. It's just suddenly I think of something. But more and more I think I would like to write full time. Now, I can cheat by saying that one thing I could do is write for film. And I told you my first written thing was a screenplay. Recently, I've been writing short films and feature-length film screenplays. And it's a very difficult thing to sell a screenplay, but it helps if you work in the film industry. And I love writing screenplays because it's very different from writing short fiction. Because all you think about is dialogue and the structure and flow. And you don't need to worry about description and even action. The director will figure those things out. But you get to focus on these characters and how they interact. And even if I never sell a screenplay, writing them helps my fiction writing. But I have not given up selling screenplays. And then, because you can make reliable money as a screenwriter, but there's a union, then maybe I could write all day. So we'll see. Ask me again in a year and we'll see how far I've gotten.
How do you envision the future of film industry?
It's a very exciting but also frightening time. This is a great question because the industry is changing, but this is one of the biggest changes since George Lucas and Steven Spielberg kind of first started inventing the blockbuster. So in the 1970s, there's this big change of blockbuster films like Jaws and Indiana Jones and Star Wars or Godfather comes out in the summer, the tent pole. And it started my industry of visual effects because you could have budgets that, you know, now in today's money are $100 million, $200, $300 million. And that became the main money-making mechanism for Hollywood. This is changing very rapidly. Sometime in the last 5 years, video games has become a bigger industry than blockbuster films. And very recently, streaming. So, scary for me because I work on these big science fiction and fantasy films, but exciting for me as a fan and as a filmmaker and as a writer, because what you're seeing is a reinvention of how films are seen and watched, even down to the format. You know, people watch on their phone, the idea of these IMAX, and giant screens, that's changed. Maybe, you know, you could tell a good science fiction story in 5 minutes on something you can watch on your phone. Maybe that comes out on YouTube and it comes out once a week, you know, at 5 minutes a shot. You will still see big, large-scale science fiction, and I'm glad of that. I love shows like The Expanse still keeping this giant blockbuster feel in episodic television. And, of course, I hope there will always be a Star Trek. But one of the biggest changes will be that people will watch short series, mini-series, 8 episodes, or maybe it's like Black Mirror, 3 or 5 episodes a year. Black Mirror is a great example of episodic, anthology shows. I think that's fantastic, and already we see a new Tales from the Crypt coming, Black Mirror, this Love, Death, and Robots series, which was on Netflix, is on Netflix, coming a second series. It's 5 to 15 minute long animations, often based on a science fiction short story. I know there was one from Michael Swanwick, great story from him. Alistair Reynolds had a story, and I'm blanking on the rest. Whole new format, going back maybe to the heavy metal comic books and the heavy metal movie back from the 70s and 80s. And I think we'll see more short films, anthology films. There's a company called Dust making 5 to 15 minute films on Vimeo. And they're trying to take their films and turn them into feature films. One I can recommend is called Prospect. They did a 5 minute version with just 2 actors, very simple props and sets, and then that funded a full feature-length film, which is fantastic. Same actors, but a larger cast and some larger special effects. Again, very low budget, though. Quiet Place, though it was released as a feature film, we'll see that future of directors making smaller films with smaller budgets. It made $400 million, but it was a budget of $5 million, a lot of money for us, but very small for Hollywood. Lets new voices, new people, directors like Jordan Peele with Get Out and Us are funding science fiction that they could not have done back in the blockbuster era. So new voices coming in, new technology is the other very exciting thing. I bought myself my VR goggles, and already Industrial Light and Magic is working on VR experiences. There's one, a facility called The Void at Disneyland and Disney World, and hopefully now in Europe, coming soon, I think, where you 4 people go into a world where you can physically interact and touch things, but you're looking through VR goggles, and they can switch the story, so you could do Star Wars or Ghostbusters or Wreck-It Ralph. They're very exciting. Inarritu, the director who did The Revenant and Birdman, other great films, he did a VR experience that we worked on where you're a migrant coming over the border from Mexico to the U.S. Very frightening, extraordinary experience to put people in the literally in the footsteps. They build a sandy soundstage and you wear your goggles and walk around so you feel like you're there when the Border Patrol comes in. Powerful storytelling through this new medium. And we use this for production as well. A friend of mine, Dermot Power, does a lot of work with Tim Burton, or for Harry Potter. So on Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, he could build a set, as he's a designer, he builds a set, and J.K. Rowling or the director can hold up an iPad and look around as if they've got a window into this virtual world. Really exciting use of new technology to solve a very old problem. And Industrial Light and Magic is pioneering virtual production where you have huge, basically television screens, 20 or 30 feet high by maybe 80, 100 feet long, wrapping around a whole set. And you put your background onto this screen and you follow the path of where the camera is, so the background always matches the camera's position. And then you build your set. So let's say you have an office and you can see the background out the windows. That background could be real photography from somewhere else in the world projected onto this giant television monitor. It's so good, it's so realistic, that we had problems in filming The Mandalorian, the new Star Wars TV show, where actors or staff members not paying attention would walk into the screen thinking they were walking down the set. You'll see lots of this new technology to give film level quality at a TV level. You could just, if the director wants a different time of day, you turn a knob and the sun moves and the lighting all works and the background changes. So very exciting, this virtual production. That's going to let us tell new kinds of stories. And once they build these facilities, that will be open to filmmakers with lower budgets. You can come in and you will bring your digital model, place it there, put your actors out there, film your shot, and go away. So very exciting time for technology. Very exciting time for new storytellers and new voices. And finally, just an international market, that streaming is everywhere. We're beginning to see film. Netflix is bringing in German shows like Babylon Berlin or Dark. So good. Just love it. And we have a South Korean series I'm blanking on now on Netflix in the U.S. But even, you know, YouTube, I go on. There was a series of short films made in Nigeria, science fiction films filmed on iPhones. And you can find them on YouTube. Incredibly, and I'm sure you and your listeners do the same. You go down to watch one thing on YouTube, and 3 hours later, you finally stop, if you're lucky. So a fantastic time for filmmaking. Who knows exactly where it's going to end up? Will all films be virtual? Will people instead just have even better iPhones and go on location? It's exciting and nobody knows. I do know, however, that it's going to no longer be just rich directors in Hollywood. It's going to be a worldwide thing for everybody to contribute to.
There was a very interesting official declaration from Disney not long ago. They told us that in the near future, only the blockbusters will be available in cinema and all the rest will be streaming. Do you want to comment on this?
I don't know the official Disney plans, but you know, I will say that there are some films that are meant to be seen in the theater, and it would make me very sad if we didn't at least have some of these blockbusters. But honestly, my niece, who is now going to college, very, very rarely goes to the theater. She will watch on her phone, she will watch on her laptop. And there are good things about that also. I also hope as theaters become digital that what we'll see is older films in theaters, you know, and you can get this experience of seeing a Hitchcock film in a theater. But yeah, I think it will be the future is that we will still see spectaculars in the theaters. And, you know, we just hope that the theater experience survives. But there's something very special going back to childhood of buying your popcorn, sitting down, and the lights go down, and the screen comes to life, that I hope we never lose.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope that I will come back some other time.
Of course.